This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Budget 2017 was noted for its generosity towards civil servants and various goodies to ease the rising cost of living, leading many observers to speculate that this is an elections budget. Helping us understand the merits of these various incentives and how it affects the B40 and M40 groups is Mahendra Nair, a professor of economics. Welcome to the show.
Hi, good evening.
So before we get to Budget 2017, let's talk briefly about Budget 2016. How well do you think it served both the B40 and M40 groups?
I think one of the things is that the B40 benefited significantly in the 2016 budget. But I think over the last 12 months, cost of living has gone up significantly. So one of the things that you see in this current budget is to supplement the additional cost of living due to the GST knock-on effect, cost of property, and a whole range of other costs. I think the government decided in this budget to really have more targeted, programs in place for the B40. So while the last budget for 2016 supplemented some of the income and support for the B40, but clearly the pressures are much more intensive over the last 12 months. And I think the B40 really appreciated what was done in 2016. And so I think to reinforce that and understanding the current circumstances with increasing costs, I think that has continued for 2017, or will be continued for the 2017 period.
So that was the B40. For M40, do we see any sort of significant help or significant change happening out of Budget 2016?
I think if you look at the budget very carefully, I think it's been orchestrated in such a way that it's what I call a people-centric, targeted, but very prudent budget, in the sense that the direct transfer, the direct effects were given to the B40. But nevertheless, the M40, there are a number of goodies for the M40. One of the clear issues for M40, clearly cost of living is very high, but from a different perspective, you see, in terms of cost of education, cost of healthcare, and also cost of rental and income. But if you see in the current budget for the 2017, you see there's a lot of support for education to relieve a lot of scholarships, even though there's a lot of suggestion that scholarships may be cut back, PTPN may be cut back, but that has still continued. We see there's a lot of support for healthcare. Also, in terms of the cost of living, there's this new provision for the youth in terms of building and allowing them to rent and save. Hopefully, that could be translated into just rent, not just rental, but rent to own. So again, I think there are a lot of indirect benefits which M40 will benefit from. I'll talk later about the education, because I think that's where a lot of support is coming towards the M40.
This year's budget allocation coming now to Budget 2017 is 260.8 billion ringgit, which is a 3.4% increase on last year's. Now, of course, here on BFM, we are not the first show to discuss the budget. We had Ng Yin Sin, Vice President of the Reform Advocacy Group CENBET, or Centre for a Better Tomorrow, earlier on Monday's Breakfast Grill, and this is what was said.
Before Friday, many people were actually speculating that this is going to be an election budget, including myself. We are looking at election happening in 2017. Whether Najib and the ministers would like to admit that whether it's going to be an election budget or not, it is an election budget to us because, as you correctly pointed out, it is to the masses. If you look through the budget cover to cover, you will realize that Prime Minister Najib actually touched on almost every community, especially the civil servants. So if I look at it from a political standpoint, I trust that he wants to win more votes from the civil service. Therefore, you see housing assistance, you see paid study leave, you see daycare services, you see a lot of goodies to the civil servants. So that's how even the servants have this big chunk of the goodie from the budget. To me, it is an election budget, but it is also the people's budget, because a lot of emphasis has been given to the B40, especially to the rural community, and even to the SMEs. For the first time, SME has got tax breaks when they achieve more than a certain amount in their profit.
So the fact that this is a people's budget, we've already talked about that, but do you agree that it also looks somewhat like an elections budget?
I think if you look at, I mean, that's one perspective. But if you look from a political perspective or from a policymaker's perspective, every budget is an election budget because you've been elected to serve the people. So and I think the perspective that they take is that, look, whether it's election is 2017 or 2018, people are expecting the policymakers to deliver. And I think this is one of the budgets from a, you know, a series of budgets that are actually catering for the B40 because that's where the pressure points are. And now in this budget, you know, the M40, there's some support for M40 and the SMEs, particularly given the fact that the you know, the regional and the national and the global competitiveness has become more intensive. I think it's going to be even more intensive with the opening up of the markets. And I think with the support provided for the SMEs, I think that's where I think they're going to be able to at least gear up for the next wave of competition that's going to come in.
So looking back to that group, of course, who comprise the bulk of Malaysians, B40 and M40, is there sufficient focus on these groups in Budget 2017?
Yes, actually, if you look very carefully, one of the areas that is really critical, which has not been discussed a lot since the budget, is that the shifting of the economy. The economy is shifting towards a more knowledge-intensive economy, and you're starting to see that you need less workers to do more. So as the economy shifts towards Industry 4.0, you're going to see that not just, I think, if the measures are not taken to scale them up to this new world economic order, I think you'll see that the B40 expanding to become B60. So I think realizing this, how do we essentially enhance the innovative capacity of our workforce, our SMEs and our industries? And in this budget, the support, it's not just financing that is critical for SMEs, but there's a lot of support for the technical education. There's a lot of support. The education budget is enormous, education training. There's support and incentives for GLCs and bigger companies to support SMEs and universities to prepare the next generation graduates. So I see this budget as it's a people's budget, but preparing them for the next wave of competition. So given the changing landscape of the economy that is taking place globally.
With that said, some analysts have said that this budget seems to have forgotten or, you know, largely ignored the M40 group, with tax consultants, for example, saying they expected the lower level tax bands to be widened to provide the M40 with extra disposable income. Also that there's no extra child relief allowances or any support in the form of a freeze on toll charges, interest deductions on their housing loan interest. Are these valid points?
I think they are valid points, but also you've got to see from a government's perspective, they wanted to keep the budget deficit within a controllable limit. So I think opening up that channel will actually expand the budget deficit. But what can they do to support the M40? And I think a lot of the support is to scale them up, you know, provide them employment opportunities, and that's a major issue. Provide them educational opportunities, given that now you can get global education in Malaysia for, you know, a much more cheaper, in a more cost-effective way, providing them with healthcare, because a lot of these costs, the cost pressures for the M40 is very different from the B40. So again, I think if you see in the budget very carefully, a lot of the support that is coming indirectly to the M40 to some extent actually provides some relief in terms of, you know, balancing their own budgets.
Broadly speaking, do you think Budget 2017 addresses the needs of the rakyat in terms of improving their standard of living?
I think generally, if you see that it does address the B40's concern with respect to, cost of living. Also, I think in terms of the M40, providing them access to the opportunities for them to become more competitive. I think you've got to take a more longer-term perspective. While the one-year budget is critical, does it set the stage for them to become more competitive in a longer term? One of the things that comes up regularly is that does the BRIM, is it a one-off? But if you see very carefully, this is where I think some work could be done, that as the cash transfers are provided, could there be better support for them to use those cash transfers to develop their own micro-businesses? There's some discussion of Uber and other support. But clearly, I think some of the cash transfers that are provided with better support, I think could help them channel those resources to build their own businesses and become more self-sustaining.
In In talking about the budget, our PM also called Malaysia an upper middle income country. Do you agree with that? Is that the bracket that we now belong to?
I think if you look at all the global indicators from, you know, from the competitiveness reports globally and then the income level, I think we are slowly gravitating towards becoming a upper middle income. But as every step we take to move up, it will require a lot more resources to push to the next stage. And I think, you know, we are on the right track. I think still early days. But I guess the most important thing is how do we scale the M40 to become the engine of growth? Well, the B40 that our support, I think the combination of the B40 and M40 in terms of building, you know, business opportunities, you know, making sure that, you know, we've got a creative workforce, that's going to be really critical to actually move, transition to a much more high income at a faster pace. I think the trajectory is right. If you see that, you know, the earlier projections of 6 to 6.5 to attain the 2020 is we're not attaining that, you know, that level. We are somewhere between 4 to 4.5. I think a lot of support now is to move to the next stage of development, which is actually a creative economy where you can get better multiplier effect. So, again, I think that given the global environment, I think that's the best I think we can probably achieve. But I think there's a lot more that can be done to transition the M40 and the B40 to becoming more self-empowered and becoming more creative in terms of adapting to this new economic order, which is, you know, a more knowledge-intensive economy.
And so the wiser way to regard the budget then is perhaps as a stepping stone towards achieving that.
Precisely. It's building the foundation for the next stage of development, which is a knowledge-intensive economy. And you can clearly see that in terms of the investments that's going into education, training. And one of the key areas that is really keeping Malaysia behind is the technical education, which to some extent we've neglected for a long time.
I'm speaking today with a professor of economics, Mahendran Nair. We're talking about Budget 2017, focusing particularly on how it's affecting the B40 and M40 groups. Up next, we find out about, well, GST, essentially. You are listening today to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Mahendran Nair, Professor of Economics, is my guest. We're talking about Budget 2017 and how it affects the B40 and M40 groups in particular. And we'll come to education, Professor, which you mentioned quite a bit earlier, later in the show. But in the meantime, of course, one of the big things that happened was GST was implemented this year and 30 billion ringgit in GST was collected last year. What is your assessment then of GST's impact on the groups we're talking about?
I think, you know, clearly I think GST has got an impact on the cost of general cost of living. But I think, you know, without the GST, we'd have been in a much more difficult position given the fact that, you know, the petrol prices have been significantly lower. I mean, you know, from $100 to almost half. And I think that's got a major impact. I think on hindsight, I think the GST has had a positive impact on the economy. I think without the GST, had you know, the funding that has come through the GST, I don't think, you know, the support for through BRIMS and others would have been possible. Clearly, I think there's some netting effect in terms of providing support for the bottom 40% that are under a lot of pressure, particularly with respect to the cost. But I think having said that, there have been quite a number of support schemes that have been put in place for the poor, particularly now, you know, support for housing and, support for education, a whole range of other things that are really, costs of, you know, has gone up significantly. So the net effect, I think, you know, is, I think it's neutral in the sense the impact on the B40. But clearly, I think the GST, you know, is in the right direction given that the global environment over the last 12 months has been dramatically changed given, you know, we are highly dependent on hydrocarbon in the past.
We also see lots of consideration given to civil servants, as we alluded to earlier, perks encompassing cash handouts and loans. Is there enough attention given to the private sector moving away from civil servants?
I think a lot of the private sector funding is coming through, you know, the corporate sector, particularly support for the SMEs in terms of access to financing. I think this is where some of the major challenges from the private sector. But also having said that, there's a lot of support. One of the big complaints among the private sector is essentially access to talent. You know, and this is a major pressure point. And I think providing access to training and, you know, capability development and also ability for the private sector to net off. If you're putting in people for training, you're able to actually get double tax deduction and so on. So again, I think there are some support indirectly for the private sector in terms of, you know, ensuring that they stay afloat and be competitive in the more longer term.
We also see the allocation for One Malaysia People's Aid, or BRIM, increased, and there were several more cash handouts announced on top of that. Now, cash handouts are, of course, something that I don't know if we're ever going to hit the end of discussing this and whether right. This is the best way of going about things. But in your opinion, at least for right now, are cash handouts a sustainable way of addressing the high cost of living or helping to alleviate the pressures of poverty?
Yeah, I think if you see there are multiple effects. One is addressing some of the cost of the B40, but more importantly, I think given that the global demand has been fairly dampened, I think the cash handouts, particularly the BRIMs and other transfers, has got a major impact on domestic consumption. So one of the ways to stimulate the economy is through domestic consumption. And again, I think, you know, with the quantum that you're speaking, I think it's got a major multiplier effect in terms of, you know, stimulating the economy. So should the global environment improve and employment opportunities and, you know, improve, I think slowly you'll see the government weaning off from the you know, cash transfer. But I think given that the global climate at the present moment in most of the developed economies, the government has no choice but to stimulate the domestic demand. And this is one quick way of doing it.
Looking at how, aside from the economy, looking at, the personal factor of sorts, the goal of BRIM is to get people off the scheme. The idea is to help people to the extent that they don't need it anymore. Is the increase in the handout then a tacit admission that the issues plaguing the poor might be getting worse instead of better?
Well, one of the things we know is over the last 12 months, I think the costs have gone up significantly. And I think the additional amount given is to keep up with the cost. But more importantly now, there's greater opportunities for them now to be able to create their own employment. And as I mentioned earlier, as the economy transitioned towards becoming a more knowledge-intensive, technology-intensive, I think it empowers people to create their own employment. And I think you'll see slowly that some of those cash transferred will be, you know, there are opportunities for them to create those employment opportunities. But I think what is needed is actually to guide them and provide a lot more support for them to be able to adapt to that change. And clearly we see that signal already has been given in this, the 2017 budget, of using some of those cash transfers to create self-employment. And I'm very certain that that's going to be intensified over the next few years, given the fact that it's quite a number of, you know, training institutes and others have been set up to help particularly, people to create micro-businesses and scale it up.
And on that note, one of the headlines that emerged fairly quickly out of the budget announcement was the PM encouraging more BRIM recipients to work with companies, for example, like Uber, in order to supplement their income. What do you think of this development? I mean, is it a good idea to push people towards the quote-unquote gig economy, you know, where positions are temporary and income might be unstable and sort of piecemeal?
Well, I think this is the reality today. I mean, this is, if you look at in more advanced countries, people are creating, multiple streams of income using the various platforms that are available. I think gone are the days that people work in one, with one employer. And I think that's the reality. And I think policymakers recognize that. There are some positive effects because you're not dependent on government or others. So you want to be able to give them the opportunity to be able to create their own employment, hopefully, you know, create their own micro-businesses and, draw in the support that is provided within the ecosystem to scale up. And I think that is how some of the top companies emerge, starting off from, their own, homes and eventually became big players. So again, I think I think a lot of the support is to create that self-employment, and I believe that you'll see that over the next few years emerging as more opportunities arise through the various changes that's happening globally through converging technology platforms.
And also to address the high cost of properties, the government is building public housing for urban youth to rent. What are the merits and pitfalls of this program in addressing this ongoing issue of affordable housing?
I think one of the things is that while, I mean, it's a good move in terms of helping the youth, particularly save in the early days, but I think the better provisions would be for them to essentially rent to own. Very similar to what, you know, if you look at our neighbours, particularly in Singapore, where a lot of the HDBs were established and home ownership was critical. And I think looking at some of the models that have worked would probably, you know, be worthwhile in terms of the long-term sustainability of that. But clearly, I think it's in the right direction given the current circumstances in terms of getting affordable homes, but a more long term is to ensure that they were able to actually own their own properties.
And just so we don't leave anybody out of this discussion, what about the top earners? Did they gain a lot from this budget?
Definitely. I think if you look at in terms of the top 20%, their challenges are to be globally competitive, because I think they're feeling intensive pressure from big players as the markets open up. What are the challenges for them? Essentially, to move up the innovation value chain, that would require support for research and development. And if you see in the budget, you know, there are support for research and development through, I mean, the universities have been endowed with a lot of funding. But I think the key thing is for industries to tap into those fundings, working with universities, and more importantly, accessing some of those resources. But the spillover benefit is that essentially you are building capability domestically, and they would be your future employees. So again, I think in terms of research and development, in terms of infrastructure development, as the infrastructure improves, you'd start seeing that Malaysia would probably be one of the best places to do business. The third thing is that also I think there's a big push towards drawing in foreign direct investments. And as we move towards the Trans-Pacific Partnership and opening up the market, you'll see a lot more interest in FDIs coming into the country. And I think the spillover benefits is going to be enormous. But again, creating a business-friendly environment for you know, the corporate sector is going to be critical.
Coming back to more vulnerable communities, do you think this year's budget did enough or much to address issues faced by single mothers, for example, or issues related to women's labour participation and the gender pay gap, which is a global issue?
Yeah, I think one of the things that we see, you know, the challenges for women, particularly single women, is actually, you know, be able to sustain themselves in an economy where costs are going up. There's a lot of support for entrepreneurship development for women to become self-empowered. If you look at the microfinances that are funding for microfinancing, you know, the support for entrepreneurship development, I think a lot of it has actually been gazetted. Some of it has been gazetted for women. But again, I think the women group have been fairly strong in ensuring that, you know, they have access to this resources. And I think the support provided by the government is again, fairly, strong. So I think we see that is the women, you know, workforce is going to be really critical in terms of driving some of the economic development. And I think the current budget provides, you know, adequate provision for entrepreneurship development, accessing financing, networking, and a whole range of support within the ecosystem. Clearly, how do we orchestrate that? And again, you know, getting the key agencies to ensure that, you know, women have, you know, equitable access to these resources.
There were also ethnicity-based allocations, such as the 150 million ringgit allocation for Tekun and Amanah Ikhtiar Malaysia, or the AIM scheme for the Indian community, and then 100 million ringgit allocation to SME Bank for loans specific to Bumiputra entrepreneurs. Do allocations based on ethnicity work?
I think one of the things that we see, particularly in some of the ethnic-based support, is that in the past, while allocations have been provided, I think some of the structural issues within those communities have not been addressed. While funding has been provided, access was a major challenge. I think in the current budget, even the past budget, while provisions have been made or ring-fenced for these groups, I think a lot more support have been provided to access those financing. A classic example is in the case of the Indian community, the establishment of SEED under the Prime Minister's office in SEDIC essentially identifies some of the challenges of you know, the micropreneurs, though financing had been provided in the past, access was a major challenge. And getting them, scaling them, helping them develop better business proposals are really critical. So ring-fencing these funds, but plus also putting in capability development programs for them to access it and develop their businesses. So I believe that as they become, more stronger participation from the community, particularly the B40s from this, groups, I think you'll see that a lot of those structures will disappear. They'll be part of the broader mainstream support scheme.
So in the meantime, then, is it safe to say that there is still room, there is still space for ethnicity-based allocations alongside allocations based on income categories?
One of the things is that I think the clear thing is that where communities that have been, having difficulty, enabling them and helping them pipe into the broader economies is going to be the game changer. And I think a lot of the wild funds have been ring-fenced. A lot of the funds are essentially to help them connect to the broader mainstream economy. And I think that's you're going to see increasingly that it's not just the Indian economy or the Bumiputra economy, but essentially helping this marginalized community pipe into the broader incentives, support scheme, and the broader economy. The Malaysian economy is becoming more and more globalized. And I think, all communities need to be piped in. And I think the support is to help them network and be piped into this new, world order, world economic order.
And you've alluded to the importance of education since the beginning of the show. Sure. And how there's allocation for that. With respect to that, students are going to be given a debit card worth 250 ringgit for books and study materials. But those from affluent families wouldn't need this. Is there a better way to lessen the economic burden of students, or is this a good start?
I think it's a good start, but I think it could be done in a much more effective way. And I think segmenting students who can afford, I think they should be able to pay on their own. But I think the students that are, belong to a certain income threshold should be provided this support, perhaps maybe even more. So I think it could have been allocated differently. But again, I think perhaps it's something that can be done in the future, particularly, identifying students that come from marginalized communities and ensuring that they have access to the resources for them to do well in their studies. So I think it could have been done better, but, I think
something is better than nothing.
That's right.
Okay. 7.4 billion ringgit for 20 public universities, 4.3 billion ringgit for scholarships. Those were two things that were announced, with numerous headlines about JPA scholarships being revoked, as well as university departments getting defunded. Is this enough money?
I think given the current circumstances, I think this is adequate funds. But one of the things that we see is that while you've got core funding coming from government, I think the universities should be made to work with closely with industry. And I think it's got to really strengthen the public-private partnership. And if you're providing core funding for infrastructure capability development, but also incentive for industries to come on board and jointly develop research programs that are strategic to the economic development of the country, and also putting in resources for capability development, PhD programs, increasing the number of research personnel. So it's a kind of a, not all government support, but providing adequate support to ensure that researchers and academics are hungry enough to work with the corporate sector to make a difference. I think sometimes opulence make you more complacent. So
it's a little bit of a carrot and a stick approach.
Precisely.
In some ways.
Precisely.
Okay. Malaysia's PPP per capita has increased from 23,100 in 2012 to 26,891 in 2015. Are we in danger of staying in a middle income trap? I mean, earlier you spoke about how we are slowly making our way towards upper middle income. But right now, I mean, are we kind of trapped in that setting?
I think, if you see, we have made progress. As I mentioned, every step that we take to move up is going to be a major challenge. But nevertheless, we are making progress. But I think if we are to make, a much more faster progress, again, one of the key things is to move towards a creative and innovative economy. And I think if you see globally, every country is moving in that direction. And part of that is developing excellent infrastructure development. And I think that's not been neglected in any of the budgets. Making sure that our universities generate the best talent. And I think in every budget, education gets very strong support. But more importantly, providing incentives for the right industries to come on board to be able to nurture and develop our innovation ecosystem. I think that is going to be really critical on how well Malaysia leapfrogs to the next stage of development.
And as we move forward, in your opinion, did Budget 2017 contain enough clear long-term measures for us to see our growth trajectory in that sense?
If you go back to the 11th Malaysia plans, the footprints of that is already there. But I think in the support under the last budget and this budget, there are elements of that to drive Malaysia to the next stage of development. The only thing is that in this budget, it is more targeted towards the bottom 40% because that's where the pressure points are, and to lift them up to the next stage of development. So clearly, it's not surprising to me. It is actually executing what's there in the 11th Malaysia plan to be able to achieve, developed country status.
And what are your thoughts on the 2050 national transformation?
I think, if you see a lot of the discussions on the direction of Malaysia has been on the high income, and high income and the growth of 6 to 6.5 to become a developed economy. But besides that income, I think there's also a mindset of what does it mean to become a developed economy and a developed mindset. That's going to take some time. And I think it's looking at holistically from not just income perspective, but intellectually, mental, and spiritually. And I think, it has to seep in and it's going to take some time. I would have thought that 2030 would have been a more realistic target as opposed to 2050. But I think, the target is set, but clearly, the 2020 mark is critical for us, key milestone in 2030. But I agree that to become a totally a holistic developed economy, we need to have a longer time frame.
Finally, to close off, not to be negative, but what was lacking in this year's budget, in your opinion? We've had an overwhelmingly sort of positive, optimistic interview. But looking at the budget, what, in your opinion, could have been improved? What would your recommendations be for 2018?
I think one of the things that can be could have been articulated better is that given the global climate, I think bigger push for government and government-linked companies to actually, use or support local industries. If you see in many of the countries in China and Korea and Japan, priority is given to local industries to support locals. So buy Malaysia first. I think that could have been a lot more stronger voice to support the local industry in all the procurement. The second thing is that in the wave of foreign direct investments, I think one of the key things that needs to be tied together is that while foreign direct investments coming in, linking them up, to very strong technology and knowledge transfer is what some of the other countries have done, so that the spillover benefits is benefiting our industry. I think those are the two things that could have been clearly articulated. And I think, if that's done, I think that'll be an impetus to our local industries, our local workforce, and clearly, I think, move Malaysia in the right direction.
Thank you very much for coming in today, Professor.
Thank you very much.
I've been speaking with Mahendra Nair, Professor of Economics. We've been discussing Budget 2017 today. You have been listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.